Job chapter 2. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you have incited me against him to ruin him without cause." And Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will curse thee to thy face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." Now when Job's three friends heard of all his adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, and they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights, with no one speaking a word to him. For they saw that his pain was very great. May God write his word upon our hearts. Many years ago, a man came to my study one morning, visibly upset and distressed. Over the years, he had built a magnificent home and had landscaped it to perfection. Down each side of the front garden, he had planted a row of flowering trees, in front of them a row of bushes and then some flowers, and there was just not a thing out of place in that garden. In the middle of a perfectly manicured lawn stood a lovely little fountain surrounded by some more flowers. It was one of those homes and gardens which might well have been featured in the Better Homes and Gardens magazine. In due course, the Roman Catholic Church decided to build a church next door. That was no problem until someone decided that there needed to be an access road between the church and this man's property. And when he came to my office, he had just received notice that his property had been condemned in order for the city to secure the necessary few feet for the driveway. And through his tears, he said to me, "Pastor, I have worked very hard for 50 years to get that home. Now that I have what I want, they're going to take it away from me." He and his wife chose to move to a modest little cottage in a quiet neighborhood. Some months later, he told me, that although that experience was exceedingly painful at the time, it was one of the best things that ever happened to him. That experience forced him to face the fact that he could not keep his house forever. He was forced to reassess his whole system of values. God, in his mercy, taught that man a lesson, and though it was painful, it was necessary. People in the world have a system of value which involves three basic elements. Those three basic elements are wealth, health, and friends. Not every individual in this world places those three in the same order of importance. But the idea is that if one has enough wealth to do whatever he wants to do, if he has good health to do it, and if he has some friends with which to do it, he has it made. In this message, I want you to think about those three ingredients. And I want you to assess your system of values. It is most important that you live your life on values which will endure beyond the day of judgment. The New Testament tells us that on that day, each man's work will become evident, for the day will show it, because it is to be revealed with fire, and the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. And as the Apostle tells us in that passage, make sure that you are not building on wood, hay, and stubble. Consider first of all the matter of wealth. Obviously, you cannot go through life without money or things, though you could probably get along quite well with a lot less than you have. Be that as it may, money and things are very, very much a part of your life and mine. And that's all the more reason for you to examine your attitude and to assess the importance of things in your system of values. What is your attitude towards wealth? Now, I'm not talking about the amount of wealth which you possess or do not possess, but rather your attitude towards it. A wealthy man might possess a good attitude, while the poor man might be consumed with covetousness. You will remember that when Jesus interpreted the parable of the sower and the seed to his disciples, he said that the thorns which grew up and choked the seed which had been sown were the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches. The deceitfulness of riches. How are riches deceitful? Well, for one thing, riches are deceitful because they promise much more than they are able to give. No doubt there have been many times when you have said to yourself, or even made the comment to your family or friends, if only I had a little bit more. If I had enough money, I would make my home more comfortable and my surroundings more pleasant. If only I had a little bit more, I would make life so much more convenient and so much easier. If only I had a little bit more, I would then be contented. I would be happy. Well, as you know, that little bit more is as elusive as the carrot before the donkey. Somehow one never quite reaches that little bit more. And we keep on pressing on in hoping that sometime, somewhere down the road, we will have enough. Riches are deceitful in that they promise life, but they cannot deliver. Because of the deceitfulness of riches, many people place the wrong value upon them, and they are enticed to pursue worthless goals throughout their lives. As you know, some of the most unhappy people in all the world are wealthy people. Riches might increase one's comfort, but they also increase one's anxiety. Riches make some pleasurable experiences possible, but they also bring problems. Wealth might provide security, but they also provide uncertainty. I've oftentimes been amused as I've gone into a bank somewhere and noticed that the bank is guaranteed by the government. My question is, who guarantees the government, especially when it is in such colossal debt? Riches are deceitful because they are so uncertain. Many a wealthy man has gone to bed at night only to waken in the morning to the fact that while he slept, something happened to his resources and his riches have vanished. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17, the Apostle Paul told Timothy to instruct those who are rich in this world, in this present world, not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. Don't fix your hope on the uncertainty of riches. Next to that verse, in one of my study Bibles, I've written the words, "Men are afraid that they will be robbed of their money, but they forget that their money can rob them of something far more valuable." Indeed, one does not need to look very far to find people who have been robbed of happiness, who have been robbed of their peace of mind, who have been robbed of their sense of security, who have indeed been robbed of life itself because of the deceitfulness of riches. As I've said, the problem is not with the amount of wealth, but with the attitude towards it. The fallacy of trusting in riches is thinking that life can be found in material resources. The second element in life, according to the world, is health. Now, your health is important. It is the path of wisdom to eat a balanced diet and to get proper exercise and rest. Our present society has become obsessed with dieting and exercise. And today, all kinds of diets and exercise machines are available to help people keep fit and keep active. Indeed, holistic medicine is one of the emphases of the New Age movement. The goal of holistic health is to attune the person, body, mind, and spirit, to the universe, the One. In spite of the fact that the New Age movement believes in reincarnation, I suspect that one of the underlying reasons for the emphasis on health stems from the conviction that deep down that there is only one life and that one had better make the most of it while he can. At least that seems to be the reason for the preoccupation with health by many people. For many, the ultimate tragedy is to grow old, to be handicapped so that normal activity is restricted or no longer possible. This idea has become so much a part of the thinking of the world that many judge that it is better not to be born at all than to be born handicapped. And if there is any possibility that the child might be born deformed or handicapped, many are convinced that it should be aborted or left to die. Further, there is growing support for the idea that the handicapped child should not be permitted to live. And one wonders, of course, if such convictions and decisions are made out of concern for the child, or rather in the interests of those who are to care for the child. His handicap, you see, might restrict the normal activities of those who must take care of him. The handicap become an obstacle to those who otherwise might be able to live a full, free, active life of fun. And the world cannot understand how a person confined to a wheelchair or a hospital bed can live. Several years ago, I had the privilege of meeting Craig. I've forgotten his last name, but he's the man, the handicapped man, who is mentioned and pictured by Dr. Schaefer in his book, Whatever Happened to the Human Race. Craig was born without a left leg and without arms below the elbows. The world would say that life for Craig is not worth living. He has, however, pursued normal studies and has graduated from California State University and Covenant Theological Seminary. And I understand that today he is involved in a ministry to handicapped people. But in his book, Dr. Schaefer quotes Craig as having said, "I am very glad to be alive. I live a full, meaningful life. I have many friends and many things that I want to do in this life. I think the secret of living with a handicap is realizing who you are, that you are a human being, somebody who is very special." Health is very important, especially to those who think only in terms of this life. Normal physical activity is essential for those whose concern is for their life on earth. But again, the question is not whether one has good health, but rather one's attitude towards his physical condition. According to the world, life consists of wealth and health, the material and the physical. If one has enough wealth to do whatever he pleases and good health to do it, he can get the best out of life, says the world. The third element necessary for life, according to the world, is friends. In other words, there is a social dimension to life. Men were not made to be hermits. We are social creatures. We were made to have fellowship with one another. We need other people with whom we can interact and commune about the things which are of interest to us and which concern us. There has never been a time when communication between people has been easier. One can pick up the phone and talk to people just about anywhere in the world without much difficulty. Probably there has never been a time when people can interact so freely. And as you will remember, at the beginning of time, God said, "It is not good for man to be alone." People must have friends. Indeed, many people today are prepared to abandon themselves in the search of what is called a meaningful relationship. The problem is not that there is a need for companionship, but rather the problem is in the way in which a person endeavors to meet that need. And in spite of the fact that communication has never been so easy, friends have never been more difficult to find. And in an attempt to find friends, these days the world considers it normal for a couple to meet, have a few drinks, and fall into bed together within a matter of hours in the hope of finding a meaningful relationship. In spite of the fact that many have given themselves to free interaction with others without inhibition, I doubt if the world has ever seen more lonely people. Yes, we need companionship, we need friends. The problem is, we don't know how to find them. So then, if you have enough wealth to do whatever you want to do, if you have good health to do it, and if you have friends with whom you can do it, you have it made. According to the world. The world looks at life purely in terms of material, physical, and social things. Now, keeping these three things in mind, let us consider our friend Job. Keep your Bibles open to chapters 1 and 2. At the outset of the book, we are informed in chapter 1, verse 3, we are informed that Job is the greatest man in the East. Probably that means that he was the wealthiest man. And since the East was the wealthiest part of the world, we might readily assume that Job was the wealthiest man in the world. At any rate, he had great wealth. The world would say, Job, you've got it made. We observe, however, from this first chapter, that the concern which caused Job to rise early each morning was not the state of the Dow Jones Industrials, but the spiritual welfare of his children. Job had great riches, but he neither trusted in them, nor was he deceived by them. And when Satan came with his accusation before God, you will notice down in verses 9 through 11, he said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and about his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will renounce you to your face." Satan is accusing Job of serving God simply because God has made him wealthy. Does Job serve God simply for what he gets from him? Well, let's see. In chapter 1, God gave Satan permission to go and take away Job's things. Now, I surmise that Satan did not go forth from the presence of God and immediately destroy all Job's possessions. I think rather that he waited for the most opportune moment, the most appropriate time. Verse 13 seems to hint at this when it says, "Now it happened on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house." Now if you look back at verse 5, you will observe that this was the time of Job's greatest concern for his children. At any rate, the day came when, within a matter of a minute or so, Job learned that a series of disasters had hit and he had lost all his possessions, including his 10 children. Now, don't tell me that Job didn't feel that. Many men have committed suicide for much less. What was Job's response? We'll look down at the end of the chapter, verse 20. "Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed, blessed be the name of the Lord.'" Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Job's response was to worship God. The word worship comes from an old Anglo-Saxon root. Originally, it meant to recognize the worthship. To recognize the worthship. Now, don't forget Satan's accusation. He had claimed that the only reason that Job serves God was because God had given him so much wealth. And now his wealth has been taken away. And what does Job do? But he recognizes the worth of his God. And I would suggest to you that the first chapter of Job proves conclusively that Job's life does not consist in the abundance of things that he possesses. Material substance, material possessions are not the sum and substance of life for Job. The loss of all that he possessed did not cause him to blame God. Rather, he blessed God. In chapter 2, the scene is essentially the same. Satan came before God again and asked, or rather God asked him, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you have incited me against him to ruin him without a cause." Satan answered the Lord by taking his accusation one step further. You'll notice in verses 4 and 5, he says, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." Satan believes that Job has a price tag on God somewhere. He is convinced that God is not glorious enough for Job to worship and to serve him simply for who he is and for no other reason. Satan therefore challenges God to take away Job's health. You notice, of course, that Satan can only go as far as God permits. But as you know, from verse 7, Satan smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. I don't know how he stood that. I had a boil on the back of my neck once, and I walked around with my neck kinked for about 3 weeks. Job had boils all over him. And this was not just a passing illness. Later in the book, we learn that Job was in months of agony, with both his wealth gone and his health gone. What does Job have to live for? His wife, you will notice, reached that point where she believed that life for Job was no longer worth living. And she advised him in verse 9 of chapter 2 to curse God, renounce God, and get it over and done with. Job, however, rebuked her for her foolishness. And he said, "Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" Though adversity had come, it had not shaken Job's faith in God. And after losing his health, as we're told in verse 10, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Job understood that life does not consist in the abundance of health that a man has, if I may paraphrase that verse. Job understood that life is more than material possessions, and it is more than physical health. In the final few verses of chapter 2, we are introduced to Job's three friends. They came to sympathize with Job. As we saw in our previous study, they argued from a purely natural level. And their explanations of Job's adversity were both cruel and they were false. There are a few things in life which cut more deeply into the heart of a person than friends who misunderstand and who make false accusations. And if Job's grief over the loss of his children was not devastating enough, Satan made sure that Job was going to suffer mental anguish at the hands of his friends. And as I think I've said before, with friends like Job had, who needs enemies? And it was not only the arguments of those three friends that must have hurt him to the very soul of his being. Turn over, if you will, please, to chapter 29. Before trouble had come, Job was well respected. He was honored by people at all levels of life. He was honored and respected by all who knew him. Look at chapter 29 and verse 7 and following. When I went out to the gate of the city, when I took my seat in the square, the young men saw me and hid themselves. The old men arose and stood. The princes stopped talking. Verse 11. For when the ear heard, it called me blessed. And when the eye saw, it gave witness of me. Because I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the orphan who had no helper. The blessing of the one ready to perish came upon me, and I made the widow's heart sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy. Come down to verse 21. To me they listened and waited and kept silence for my counsel. Obviously from that chapter, Job was a humanitarian in the best word, the sense of the word. He was concerned for the poor and the needy, and he did what was right. He did what was just. He was respected to the point where the old men arose when he entered their presence. And princes were silent. Job had been a true friend to many people. He had earned their respect. But with tragedy and affliction coming upon him, the attitude of people changed dramatically. And so you will notice his words in chapter 30 and verse 1. But now those younger than I mock me. Come down to verse 9. And now I have become their taunt or their song. I have become a byword to them. They abhor me. They stand aloof from me. And they do not refrain from spitting at my face. Those whom Job had helped had turned against him. Poor Job. He had lost his wealth, his health, and his friends. The world would say that Job has lost all the essential ingredients for life. Job, according to the world, had nothing left for which to live. Job, however, knew, and he proved for us, that life does not consist of wealth, health, and friends. He knew that life consists of a personal relationship with God. That does not mean, of course, that these other things are not important. It does mean, however, that they are viewed from an entirely different perspective. As I mentioned earlier, the amount of wealth is not important. What counts is one's attitude to what he has. Job's relationship to God gave him a perspective on life which disaster and suffering and insults could not shake. Job's life did not depend upon circumstances. It did not depend upon people. You see, friends, we do not live in a chance world where we are at the mercy of circumstances or where we are at the mercy of fate. We live in a world in which there is a sovereign God who is in complete control. Life depends not upon what happens, but upon God. And what ultimately matters is for you to have a personal relationship with God. Have you discovered the answer to life? If you were to lose your home, your investments, your wealth, your health, your family, your friends, what would be your response? Could you say truthfully, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. If you lost all those things that the world considers essential for life, would you fall down and worship God? My challenge to you this morning is that you examine your system of values in the light of God's Word, to make sure that you are laying up treasures where it really matters. In our next study, we're going to begin to discuss those three major questions that I raised at the outset. You remember that we are beginning to consider the question, what is life? And in order to answer that question, we must answer the other three questions. What is man? What is God? And what is evil? Job, you remember, was a man who feared God and turned away from evil. In other words, Job discovered the answer to the problem of evil and had been reconciled to God. He had found a personal relationship with God. That is why disaster, suffering, and the insult of friends could not move him. He knew the answer to life. You'll remember that Jesus said, "This is life eternal, that they may know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom he has sent."